Hello and welcome to Sobremesa Podcast. My name is Owen Gilmartin and today my guest is Brittany Kennedy. Brittany is Professor of Practice at Tulane University in New Orleans and is the author of Between Distant Modernities, which is an interesting comparative book on Spanish nationalism and Southern nationalism in the United States. Hey Brittany, how are things?
Good, Owen. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great to have an opportunity to speak. We've sort of been interacting on Twitter for a long time, but never actually having the opportunity to speak. So this is great. Part of the reason why we're having this conversation now is, I guess, in the wake of the elections. I mean, you've done a lot of research on Spanish nationalism and particularly around, I guess, how Spanish nationalism, I guess reactionary nationalism in particular, frames things in terms of the exceptionality of Spanish culture, Spanish national identity. And this conversation originated because you sent out a tweet which got a lot of sort of interesting traction and responses around Vox and the politics of nostalgia and the importance of nostalgia for understanding the extreme right. Now, we're going to get to that in a minute. I also wanted to ask you first about, I guess, the news that's happening today that in the Spanish Parliament they've just voted to allow for the first time since 78 that parliamentarians, MPs can respond in the minority languages in Basque and in Gallego and in Catalan. You're someone who you're an expert in Basque culture. I think you spend your summers in the Basque country, etc. I mean, how important is this as a, at least symbolically, that, you know, we are recognizing the sort of plurilinguistic and plurinational reality of Spain as a country?
I think it's fundamental. I think there's to some degree, you know, the dictatorship was very during the dictatorship. These languages were banned. I mean, on the street, you would go to jail for speaking them. Certain Basque names, you couldn't name your child certain names. My son, actually, his name is Kepa, which was a banned name.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. And so there was this very distinct, decision to ban Basque culture or ban Catalan culture on the part of the dictatorship. And I remember speaking with somebody who's older who grew up during the dictatorship. And he said when he was a young man, he went to France and you go to the French Basque country and you'd see Basque flags and you would occasionally hear Basque. And it felt like going to the moon to him. But at the same time, Basque nationalism is, I would say, stronger on the Spanish Basque side. And he said that he thought that perhaps the best thing that the dictatorship ever did was tell us that we didn't have a culture because we would spend a lot of energy declaring that we do. And so the fact that now the state is, and I think post-dictatorship, there has been some sort of, I love the word reivindicación in Spanish, right? This desire to reignite or re-recognize that these autonomous communities are culturally distinct and they have a distinct culture. Recognizing that linguistically is big. It's a big deal. It recognizes, I think, a linguistic plurinationalism that is really, really fundamental to resisting Spanish mono nationalism to a degree. I think it's a really big deal. I don't know how the logistics of it are going to work because Gallego and Catalan are pretty easy to understand. Basque is a whole other thing.
Exactly.
So it'll be kind of interesting to see how it works out. But I don't think MPs are really going to scream and Basque at each other or scream and Basque at their Catalan counterparts.
Abascal can maybe bring out his Basque. I presume he knows some, does he? I don't know.
Sure. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it'd be kind of great to see it happen. But I think it's going to be more along the lines of, you know, the kind of code switching they do, you know, like in the Basque country. I always struggle when I get back because I say yes, no, hello, goodbye, please, and thank you. Okay. Even when I'm speaking Spanish, I still say it in Basque, right? So I think it'll be more like stuff like that. But I think it'd be fun to watch. But I think it's important. I actually think it's important.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, linguistic recognition is
definitely
huge.
Yeah. I mean, I presume in that sense, yeah, they'll have to employ extra translators or, you know. But it is, I mean, you were saying, but just before we started, we were talking a little bit about, I guess, education policy. The question of bilingual education. I mean, I'm back in Dublin at the moment, and one of the things in Ireland I'm always struck by is the divergence between north and south on this question. Because as you were saying, in some ways in the north, when I go to Belfast, Gaelic, Irish, the Irish language is a much more active part of their political identity for Catholics, because yeah, it is a question of demanding recognition, of feeling part of your culture marginalized. Whereas in the South, I think there has unfortunately been a certain sense that Irish is backward, or it's not useful, or it's not a useful language, quote unquote. When I look at Catalonia or the Basque Country, I'm always a bit envious in terms of they've pushed bilingualism. You know, at the end of the day, if you take the majority of your classes from four onwards in that language, you're gonna at least leave school with a very high level of sort of functional Basque or Catalan.
Absolutely.
How has your experience been, and how do you view this sort of bilingual education system?
I think bilingual education in general, with taking advantage of the fact that children learn languages so easily. So I think worldwide, you're seeing more and more of that. But I think that in the case of Catalonia and the Basque Country, and Galicia to a certain degree, it's a bold move. It requires a great deal of financial investment on the part of these autonomous communities, which is why I think it's been more successful in the Basque Country and Catalonia than, say, Galicia, because they're wealthier autonomous communities, so they can invest in educating the teachers to do it, into building a curriculum, into creating institutions because the Basque language had to be standardized. It was standardized for a period of time before it could be instituted in public schools, creating curriculums. All of this takes resources, and the Basque Country and Catalonia have a lot more of those resources than Galicia, for example. Or I have a colleague who's from Peru, and Quechua has never been standardized, and so it's still very much a big language.
When did that process begin or take place? And obviously with Catalan, you would have a much longer trajectory, I presume, but
you do. And Catalan doesn't have as many variances, because it's still a Romance language, and so it's still comprehensible. Basque, Euskera Batua, it's actually originally standardized by Sabino Arana, who is the founder of Basque nationalism and the Basque Nationalist Party, and is a very controversial figure in terms of the creation of Basque nationalism, because it's very monolithic and a little bit racist and xenophobic, right? Okay. And so that part is very controversial, but it's fully standardized in sort of the late 60s going into the 70s. And then the Ikastola curriculum, the Ikastolas start happening after the dictatorship, obviously. And so Euskera Batua is what's taught in the schools. And it's very different than the Basque that you hear older people speak, or particularly the Basque that you hear in the French Basque Country, where the Basque language is in the community of Sar and French Basque Country, the rates of speaking Basque are very, very high, but it's not standardized Basque, and the population isn't very high. So it's not that many speakers. It's just the rates higher. But in the school system, it's been fundamental and it's been successful. You hear young people on the street, in the train, speaking Basque. You hear it. And I'm assuming it's the same way in Catalonia. And it's been very, very successful. I think that for a lot of people, the act of speaking the language is a political act, much like you say in Northern Ireland. When you make a decision to speak that language in the street, especially given the fact that they speak both, right? So if you make a decision to speak that language, you are making, I think for a lot of people, you're making a political decision to express yourself in your culture. And I think that has informed so much of their education policy, and I think their political policy as well.
Yeah. I mean, what were the rates of Basque language speaking in the 60s and 70s? Would it be mainly a rural phenomenon? Has there been a really strong revival in that sense? Whereas I presume in Catalonia, it seems the dictatorship never really broke it. It was always, spoken at home, at least, et cetera, even in the cities, et cetera. Whereas was it a similar or different trajectory for Basque?
It was, I think, probably depending on where you are. Yes. So, you're obviously going to have a lot more vigilance in city street in the cities.
Yeah.
And originally, the Ikastolas and the San Jose Basque, they were urban movements. The first Ikastolas are in the cities, right? Because they existed during the Second Republic, right? Yeah. But and so initially, it was actually sort of an urban movement. But during the dictatorship, my sense is that it was preserved more in the caserío, in the rural communities, because you could get away with speaking it at home much more effectively than you would have been able to pull off in a city, right? If your neighbors hear you speaking it, thin city walls where you hear, everybody I know complains about the one old lady they live next to that talks on the phone really loudly at 10 o'clock at night, right? And she knows exactly her life
exactly
story.
No, I mean, the insulation in Spanish buildings is pretty non-existent. I mean,
it's non-existent. Yeah. So you wouldn't have risked, I think, in a city center, speaking the language like that. And the other place that I think it would have been preserved was in the gastronomical societies in the Chocos.
Okay.
I've been reading recently about the history of San Sebastian earlier, and San Sebastian actually had a large population of folks from Gascony, and so there was a large Gascon speaking population in San Sebastian, and the preservation of that language actually happened in gastronomical societies and cofradías and in those spaces. And so I know some people have done a little bit of research on the gastronomical societies in the Chocos and Basque culture. I'm really interested in those spaces as linguistic spaces and to what degree the language would have been preserved because you were with a community of people that you could trust. I think, you know, but, you know, documenting that would be really challenging, of course. But
yeah. Yeah. No, very interesting.
Yeah. But it was banned, and you would go, I think the dictatorship was much more oppressive towards the Basques in a lot of ways than the Catalans, because the Basques were seen as traitors.
The Basques were. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they were Carlists.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So they flip, right? During the Carlist Wars, they're conservative, because they're conservative, they're Catholic. Yeah. Right. And the Second Republic, they shift. And so this is why they bomb the bejesus out of the Basque country. It's because they're seen as traitors. I mean, Franco said, I want to punish them. I want to punish the Basques. So it's a different relationship, I think, the dictatorship had to both cultures.
I mean, it is interesting in both areas, like Catalonia and the Basque country, that you do have, I mean, you see it very much in Catalonia, like a sort of strong extreme right Spanish nationalism. You know, it's marginal, it's minority, but it at the same time, you know, has huge influence because of its the allies it has, etc. And I presume in the Basque country, I mean, when I think back, I wrote a piece on the sort of continuation of the sort of Francoist, you know, economic ruling class, etc. And when, you know, one of the key companies there is Iberdrola, no? I mean, the Basque. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Basque financial elites as well. I mean, you know, these were the Basque ruling class in that sense, the capitalist class elites backed Franco heavily. I think the head of Iberdrola was, you know, also the head of the Falangist.
Mm-hmm.
Became the Bilbao mayor and the 40s, etc. So like there is that, I presume there is that sort of class tension as well. I mean, we have this sort of linguistic thing, but there's a sort of certain intersectionality there, I guess, between class and national linguistic identity.
Absolutely. And I think, well, you know, something we talk about is part of the reason that the Basques have an economic agreement with Spain that is much maligned or much beloved, depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah, exactly.
In the sense that the Basques collect their own taxes, there's a quota, and they turn it over to the Spanish state. And part of the reason it survives even through the dictatorship is because Alava and Araba and Nafarroa, or Alava and Navarra, remain loyal. And so it's preserved in those spaces during the dictatorship as a way of sort of thanking them. And it remains. And then it's passed on to the Basque autonomous community in the post-dictatorship period. And we have the Basque Economic Agreement today. It's controversial depending on who you're talking to. But that economic nationalism and this linguistic nationalism, definitely they intersect and they butt heads simultaneously in ways that are kind of, I think, that are really interesting.
No, I mean, it is obviously it's one of the main culture wars in Spain over the last number of years. No, I mean, the battle in the classroom, I think more, at least in terms of the media, it's got more attention in Catalonia.
Yeah.
And we've had sort of cases in the Constitutional Court about what percentage of classes need to be taught in Castellano and Spanish, etc. But yeah, I mean, it is this point of tension. I mean, do you see, because we were talking, I think, a little bit earlier about you had a personal experience with you and your son in a movie theater. You were saying you were speaking in Spanish and someone turned around and asked you to speak in Basque, etc. I mean, there is certain tensions there. You're generally in agreement with the Basque linguistic policy.
Yeah.
How would you distinguish that from how that policy exists in the minds of the Spanish right as a sort of oppressive tool, etc.?
Yeah, I think I think they're getting less and less a way of it, of seeing it as an oppressive tool. And I think part of that has come out of, I think, the rhetoric that has come out of the Basque institutional systems. has been less of you have to speak Basque to live here and more of this is an essential component to our community and it's something that we want to make accessible to you. And that's a very important difference. That it's it doesn't, because the Spanish were, I think the Spanish elites and the Spanish right were very, you could play this game of, well, we banned your language during the dictatorship. You're banning our language now. And for a long time, I think the autonomous communities and the Spanish state did this tit for tat back and forth of you're calling us fascists because we tried to destroy your culture. But what you're trying to do is eliminate Spanish culture. And what about the citizens from Spain that live in your autonomous community? What are you doing to them? And you could get in this back and forth where nobody, you know, got anywhere with this. And the Catalans, I think, were more successful with this because, again, Catalan is so similar to Spanish that that integration was a bit more seamless. It's not the situation with Basque at all. Basque is a much more challenging language and is very, very different. So I think the on the part of the Basque education system to say that, no, this is something that we want to offer. This is something that, and we think that is something that is a universal right. So you have a right to be attended to in your own language. It is a human right to be able to speak the language that you identify with. And it's important to us as a cultural institution, our cultural institutions, to make this available to you. That's a very, those are, that's a democratic principle. That's a coming from a place of human rights.
Yeah.
And I think very much informs the politics of the Basque left. I think it's very much informed the politics of organizations like Eh Bildu, which is the Basque Independence Party. They've really adjusted their policies and their rhetoric to defending democratic principles instead of imposing cultural mores and mindsets and languages. And it's different. It is, I think it hits differently now than it did, I think, even a decade ago.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. No, totally. I mean, so moving on to, I guess, our main topic. I mean, your initial tweet here was, I think you were responding to a radio interview with the head of Eh Bildu, Arnaldo Otegi. And he said, listening to an interview with Otegi this morning, he described the politics of nostalgia. The fact that this nostalgia is so popular among young people is a testament to, one, Spain's historical memory problem, and two, the left's inability to articulate a progressive patria. And it is striking, I guess, that Vox's main base of, or it's in terms of age group, its main group of support is with 18 to 24 year olds. Younger. I mean, we can talk about this. I mean, I still don't think it's necessarily a transversal electorate in the sense that these are basically young people coming from young right wing families. No, I mean, they're coming who are being socialized in very particular circumstances. I'm thinking in the north of Madrid, in the sort of what would be like the northeast around Pozuelo, different suburbs like that, very wealthy suburbs where their education system would be very religious. They would be sort of involved in Catholic youth groups linked to Opus Dei or whatever. It's a very particular form of socialization. I mean, it does go beyond those type of areas as well. But it's, you know, we also saw, I think, a couple of weeks ago, there was the Catholic International Youth Day in Lisbon. And there was a couple of videos from that coming of Spanish, young Spanish Catholic teenagers singing Cara al Sol, the Falangist anthem. There was also the video, I don't know if you saw, of the Valley of the Fallen, of a group, again, a group of young Catholics. What were they were, you know, dancing.
It was sort of like a dance party kind of vibe
It was so bizarre. I mean, I mean, that's a lot of different elements. But can you explain, firstly, I mean, one of the responses, okay, to this politics and nostalgia tweet you sent out was like, you have to be alive to understand that, right. Which obviously, I mean, the person who sent that, who's quite a prominent journalist, writes a lot about Brexit as well. And obviously Brexit is based around nostalgia, going back to sort of like 1940 Battle of Britain type stuff. Your book deals with sort of the perceived past. No, like, yeah. I guess, you know, nostalgia isn't something that necessarily has to be lived. It's about the perception of the past. It's about, like, you know, how, not, you know, an idea of the past as such. I mean, first question, what is the idea of the past that these young people tend to have? And what does it say about, the Spanish Rite?
Well, I think that the number one with these young people, and I think what's really interesting about this is this particularly Catholic youth sort of movement in Spain has a really large TikTok presence. It's based a lot in TikTok. And TikTok is, the algorithm of TikTok is really horrifying. I've only been on TikTok a little bit, but my students are the ones who I teach university, and they're all very tapped into it. So these youth can find each other very, very quickly. And the images of it are very, very striking. And they have the Valley of the Fallen right behind them, which is this striking image, right?
Yeah.
And so the image of the past that these young people have, there isn't one, right? That's the problem, is they have not been taught any of this in school. Spain's historical memory problem, I think the biggest place that it exists is in the school system.
Yeah.
And if you ever have seen the documentary, The Silence of Others, Pedro Almodóvar, they did interviews on the streets with young people. And they said, what did you learn about the Civil War in school? What did you learn about any of this in school? And they said, well, we didn't. Right. And when even now in mainstream Spain, when you talk about the Civil War, you talk about the dictatorship, there's one story. It's generally one story. Right. And you have the Basque and the Catalan versions that are a little bit different. Right.
Yes.
And so you get into this, and so you can get into this, you know, which story is right, which story is wrong. And so for this youth, you know, people say, well, there's, you know, you can have to live the history and experience it. And I actually came back to this person as somebody from the Deep South, where Civil War reenactments are really popular.
Yes.
Right. And people visit plantations without acknowledging the atrocities of slavery that occurred at them all the time.
Yeah,
I obviously fundamentally disagree that you have to live a period in order to have nostalgia for it. So that's what's actually so dangerous about nostalgia, is that it doesn't have to be real.
No,
it can be fabricated. And that's sort of what my book's about, is that when you have this loss of a national identity, you want to replace it. You want to create a nostalgia, but it doesn't have to be anything real. It can be completely fabricated. It can be completely invented, and it can be completely informed by these contemporary socializations of Catholic youth groups. I use sports. Sports is a big part of this, right? I think, and in the case of Spain, both bullfighting and football play into ideas of masculinity that inform these movements. And so that's what's really so troubling to me, is actually that these young people are utilizing an iconography and a rhetoric with a very, very repressive social politics. And the two don't resonate to them at all.
And
see what's problematic.
What do you, I mean, this is a very hard question to answer, but what do you imagine it means to them, in the sense of, I mean, is it, I mean, because there is one element, and you see this being written about in sort of progressive media in Spain, that in some ways transgressive, or that it's like, you know, a sort of, you know, F you to the progressive consensus or whatever. You're singing Cara al Sol. They know it's something they shouldn't be doing. It's slightly taboo. Does it go beyond that? I mean, I think it does. I mean, I think one of the most interesting figures, obviously, on the Spanish right is the Madrid regional president or regional governor, Isabel Ayuso. The sense, because there is a certain sense, even, you know, as a sort of supposedly mainstream right-wing figure, you know, the sense of sort of, you know, pride in right-wing Spanish nationalism, sin complejos, you know, without any sort of, and in a sense, even with her, there is a certain, I hate to use the term, but like, so, I mean, what's punky edge, or like, you know, sort of a certain.
She's edgy.
You know, yeah, exactly. She is edgy. Yeah. She, you know, she doesn't give a fuck, like, basically, you know, and that's, there is something. I guess there is, I mean, well, you look at her voting record. There is something appealing, obviously, with that. What does it mean, embracing this stuff? Is it sort of, you know, these are tend to be sort of wealthy right wing conservative teens? Are they just, you know, part of it does seem to be a certain assertion of class pride, of, you know, embracing Spanish nationalism? Yeah, the edginess of talking about these things. Does it go beyond that? What, like, how do you see it?
I think I see it as a, I think it comes out of, and Otegi talks about this in the interview, this crisis of the loss of the 78 regime, this dichotomous left-right system in Spain that was sort of an echo of the dictatorship. And when that broke down, I think that was really the end of this Francoist model of political nationalized Spanish expression. And that loss of that has meant among the youth are, I think there was a movement among the youth of that. They felt they should be sort of ashamed, or they shouldn't be proud of being, you hear this a lot of, there's been a lot of this with the reivindication of Columbus, right? Why can't we be proud
Of
No, totally.
Actually, I think you're right. This is a key element to sort of the sense of becoming, positioning yourself as a victim. I mean, this is key, key to Vox's discourse as well. I mean, that,
Absolutely. And I think in the case of, and I think part of the issue is that the left has not been able to articulate a sort of attractive, productive nationalism, right? And they've, and I also, for the record, don't think they've produced a great deal of policy that has appeal to youth as well, right? I mean, they are, I think Sanchez is better than that in some ways, but, and this is where, and not always to bring it back to Basque politics, but this is where the Basque Country has come in, and Eche Bildu has said, a free Basque Country will be a workers' Basque Country. And they have done a lot. They did very well in the municipal elections, and they've their campaign posters are not the slogan is Egingo Dugu, which is we will do it, lo haremos. And that their campaign posters are all about ley de vivienda. They're all about mass tourism. They're all about very specific historical memory topics that are specific to the towns that they're in.
Yeah.
So they have played a very local politics game and articulated it within a strong, cohesive nationalism. And I think a big thing that they've done is they've incorporated Navarra into this as well.
Of course,
And have articulated that Navarra is part of this as well. And that hasn't happened. I mean, the Podemos movement and I think Sumar, which has come out of that, I think they tried. And I think Pablo Iglesias, I think whenever I show pictures of him from that period, my students say, I feel like he's just trying to be Obama. Right. And he was trying to like tap into that. And I think he was. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
But it felt very globalized. It felt very, it felt very European.
Yeah.
And I think there's this fear of Europeanization that has existed in Spain since, I mean, the Enlightenment, really.
I guess we are talking.
That's a 19th century fear.
Yeah. No, exactly. And your book deals with that a lot, actually, which is quite interesting. Yeah. And we can come on to that. But we are talking, I guess, contemporary-wise, we're talking, well, and going back to the period your book deals with, but two
polarized... It's an old story,
Spains. No, they're intertwined. I mean, you can't, as you said, the crisis of the 78 regime, I guess what we're talking about after 2008 in particular, from 2011 in particular, you know, sort of a triple crisis, as I tend to say, the territorial, the economic, financial crisis, and the institutional crisis around corruption, etc. Yeah, I mean, and then you can trace the radicalization of the Spanish right, I think, from Podemos. Obviously, a key point was the Catalan independence push. I mean, the alternative question then of trying to articulate a progressive nationalism or progressive patriotism. It's true, like Podemos, Iglesias tried. You know, I interviewed.
They tried.
I remember him talking about it when I interviewed him, and it's a difficult one to get right because how do you articulate it? So a plurinational patriotism. It's not an easy thing to do. And I think particularly after the Catalan independence push, there was a move away from it. And I think that as much reflected the moment and the sort of the fact that the left was on the defensive as it did necessarily a weakness in the Spanish left's discourse. Yeah, I mean, It is a difficult one. I mean, what sort of analogy would you draw, or like what comparison would you draw, I guess, between this type of nostalgia and the nostalgia which you deal with in your book, which, you know, is obviously goes back to the turn of the century and which informed Spanish fascism, etc. Before the elections, I read one of key theorists is, you know, probably the leading figure in Vox, apart from Abascal Jorge Buchete, his book on sovereignty. And, you know, He definitely, you know, you can see that sort of nostalgic streak, particularly around the idea of, you know, a small, you know, the sort of band of soldiers, you know, small minority that can save the Spanish nation, etc., from its enemies within and without. But why? I mean, your book deals with particularly, I guess, the rethinking of Spanish nationalism after the Cuban War, the loss of the Cuban War in 1898. You know, this was the loss of empire, the sort of traumatic event for the Spanish right. I'm sure you could. I mean, what's this was obviously a traumatic event. Yeah, I mean, Spain loses its last imperial territories. Yeah, I mean, can you talk about like this trauma and how they tried to, I guess, yeah, reimagine Spanish nationalism in that moment?
Well, I think in that particular moment, I think they try to reimagine it as I think this loss of empire and this loss of hegemonic control within Europe, right? I think the deciding then is if we aren't this grand European power, then we're going to articulate a nationalism that is seen as specifically as different. Yes. I think that's yeah. And that extends throughout the dictatorship to its own tourist campaign.
Yeah,
right?
Fraga's slogan.
Spain is different. Yeah. And even now, I mean, this is I always tell people ask me like, why did you compare these two places? And I would say, I grew up in New Orleans. I'm from here originally. And when you grow up in New Orleans, everybody tells you, you hear all the time, New Orleans is different. And it is different. I mean, it is a different place than the rest of the United States. But when you grow up here, it doesn't feel different. It just feels the same. It feels like anything else. And so then when I went to study abroad, everyone told me, Spain is different. Spain is different. and I got to Spain and it didn't feel that different to me. It actually felt very, very similar.
Yeah.
For reasons that I ended up writing an entire book about. If people keep telling you something's different and it doesn't feel different, you start realizing that that's a word that has a lot of meaning, right? Yeah, Somebody has spent a lot of time and a lot of energy defining what that difference is. And in the case of Spain, I think it was, I think you talk about this band of soldiers. I think it's very masculine. There's a mainline hardcore masculinity tied to it that you could tie to the figure of the bullfighter. The father figure of Franco. I think that it is, in the case of Spain, I think Catholicism and the church informs a great deal of this identity.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the focus on pageantry, and you look at this in terms of the fiestas that are associated with church in Spain and Semana Santa, right? There is a iconography and a pageantry that is very attractive, that is very bold, the colors and the smoke. And so I think there's actually a correlation to that pageantry and what you see these young people doing on TikTok, right?
Okay.
I think it's the same type of spectacle. Yeah. It's this desire for an iconography and a spectacle that they can identify with, that they can call their own. What I think has been a shift, which I think is really interesting, is you talked about Isabel Ayuso, but that the main populist figures in Europe now, you look at Marie Le Pen, you look at George Meloni, they're women.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking about this in terms of Isabel Ayuso and why are they women? And I think the reason they are is that, there's somebody on Twitter who writes a lot about Basque nationalism as well, Joseba Gabilondo, and he wrote an article about Rosalía. And particularly about how the female body as an image is actually a better representation of Spain as sort of a failed hegemony. And it goes back even to Goya, right? The maja desnuda, the maja vestida, Spanish femininity has always been divided into this two parts. One is this mother figure that needs protection and love. And the other one is this strong woman who will give birth to the nation.
Okay, yeah.
And what I think that populist movements in European culture today have actually been able to capitalize on both of those images and say, see this traditional mother figure, this traditional woman that's going to give us a new Italy, a unified republic in France and a better Spain. She's a feminist figure. If you have a problem with this woman, then you're not being a feminist, right? And of course, the other part of the story is that that's the only figure of femininity that they're really interested in. They're not interested in the other tenets of feminism that are important. But I think that's why these figures are actually women nowadays, is because they've been able to tap into this monolithic, nationalistic, in some ways plural images of femininity and say, well, this is a feminine, we're feminists, right? We're strong women. We're strong women that believe in motherhood. I think George Meloni, the speech he gave Marbella, she said, they're trying to take motherhood away from us.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember that was one of the most striking lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting in that sense, because Vox hasn't gone down. Obviously, its leadership is very masculine in that sense.
It is, yeah.
And in some ways, I mean, I've been trying to think of a bit exactly about the difference between Box and Ayuso in that sense, because we have that sort of Trumpian element in both. I think the nostalgic element is clearer with Vox in the sense of, yeah, make, you know, the last Vox campaign video before the elections, the first lines in it were something like, you know, for those who remember better times and for those who have never experienced better times, you know, this, you know, as yeah, this return to a sort of more authentic experience, like the sort of, yeah, I mean, I guess what they both want to reclaim is that they defend common sense, that they defend the values and common sense values and experiences of normal everyday Spain against, you know, sort of out of touch progres or whatever. One of the other differences, I guess, is Vox's, I guess, its language, etc. It is much more, it's closer to traditional sort of Spanish fascism or Francoism. I mean, it's, whereas I think what's interesting about Ayuso is that she is, as we said, slightly more edgy, more modern. There's, in a sense, you know, her slogans around libertad, but also, like, you know, what does libertad mean for her? It means basically, it means bullfighting. It means going to mass. It means, yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, that's, yeah. It's the same elements, but it's in a different framework. Whereas obviously with Vox, it's just more, this is the essentialist in a sense. This is the nation. You don't have a choice. This is what you belong to.
Well, that's why I think that coming from the mouth of somebody like Isabel Ayuso hits way differently than coming out in these campaign ads from Vox, right? Because Vox does feel much more, it feels stale, it feels stodgy. And I think part of the reason they failed, and there's been a lot of rhetoric about how they did that, is that they relied on this iconography that just didn't resonate. Yeah. You know, the que te vote chapote stuff and the, you know, the posters with throwing the trans and LGBT stuff, yeah, in the trash. And it just didn't resonate among their youthful followers. Where somebody like Ayuso can really tap into something very positive. And, you know, I believe in bulls and I believe in going to mass and I believe in this version of, and I can, and as a woman, I can declare that I'm doing this and I'm declaring this as a woman and this is,
yeah, this is what I want.
This is what I want. This is what I want. I'm edgy and I'm cool. And, you know, and I think the counterpoint to this is Sanchez going on a Gen Z podcast and talking about Taylor Swift, right?
Yeah.
This is, and he did something that I think somebody like Emmanuel Macron, who has not been successful, he's struggling to maintain this center-left coalition in France. And he's really, really unlikable. Even though Macron's had a lot of success, but he's sort of unlikable as a figure.
Yeah.
Right. He just doesn't resonate with French people. And Sanchez, you know, he's kind of, I think he really learned from a lot of this. And he went on this talking tour and he went on the radio, and I never in a million years thought I would see Pedro Sanchez on a Gen Z podcast talking about Taylor Swift, but here we are. And I think that's part of the reason he did.
I always think about Macron is the image of what a French president should be for the professional managerial class of Spain or of France. No, it's like, I mean, they enjoy, I think they respect his distance, is, you know, when he gives out to people who don't call him, you know, president or whatever, like, you know, it's very, you know, I think they nearly respect it. But yeah, no, Sanchez has definitely learned.
Yeah. The two systems are very different too, because France is a very, they have this, the post-war French model, like really embraced the state and the republic, yeah, and their executive branch is, you know, you vote for the president, it's very much a manifestation of that. Spain is a totally different animal relative to the dictatorship and this dual party system that comes out of the dictatorship, and now this crisis that we call the crisis of the loss of the 78 regime that has inspired this weird nostalgia. And I think the other thing too is that it's a nostalgia that it doesn't have. I think the biggest difference is that, you know, I call my books called Between Different Distant Modernities. And so I talk a lot about modernism, and modernism is a movement, and modernism is a movement believes that there is no one big truth, but there are a lot of little truths, right? That truth is this something that you may not actually get there, but that it's worth seeking out. Postmodernism completely abandons the idea of a subjective truth. And that has actually, it's ironic to me that has been so beneficial to these right-wing movements that have associated themselves with these really strong sense of nationalism. But they're ones that ideologically, there's not a lot there. You know, in the US, it's, you know, Trumpism is, you know, God, guns, glory, et cetera, yeah, the make America great again.
Yeah.
But from a policy standpoint, what does that really mean? Not a whole lot. It's really attractive. but there's not much there. I mean, I don't think even Trump believes half the stuff that comes out of his mouth, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, in the case of Vox, I think that it's a little, I think they have generational trauma, I guess we could say, or generational baggage of all this iconography to draw from in terms of the church, in terms of bullfighting and the flag. But when you look at, when they actually start putting forth policy, when they actually employ a lot of these tactics, it doesn't hit as well as they think it's going to. I think particularly among young people, older people maybe, but I don't think with the young people, it doesn't resonate as well as they thought they did. I think a lot of the things they tried this last go round just didn't work. And I think
We are talking about very, very small margins at the same time. I mean, I feel, you know, at the same time, Vox only lost 2.5% of its vote compared to 2019.
Right.
In the electoral system, not translating into a much, much steeper drop. Unless their core base is further shrunk from like sort of 12-13%, they still will play a fundamental role within the Spanish political system. You're right. Like, I don't know if there's much more room to grow with their current sort of discursive strategy. But at the same time, I still think, Ayuso will take over in the PP and will
absolutely
try and basically, you know, marginalize Vox as she has managed to do in Madrid. Going back to this idea of exceptionality, which I think is a really interesting, you know, and I think anyone who's spent much time in Spain and you talk to Spanish people, even the way they talk about maybe how they distinguish Spain and Europe, that Spain's not part of Europe. And for me, it was striking because I think Irish people, you know, Irish and I think the UK do it as well. You know, they talk about the continent or whatever. Whereas when Irish people think of Europe, when they think of the continent, they're thinking of Spain. Whereas in Spain, they'll talk about, you know, the Spanish timetable versus the European timetable or whatever. Yeah. And there is a sense, you're right, like on one level, there's the exceptionality, Spain's supposed exceptionality can be embraced on the right. Part of Vox's discourse around this is, you know, there's sort of attacks on the sort of UN development goals. The Agenda 2030 is a sort of, you know, homogeneous, nearly quasi-communist, you know, government being imposed on national particularities. Or they even talked about the new Bauhaus, which in reality was just like UN, or not even UN, EU regulations for insulation of housing or whatever. You know, it was about sort of eco regulations for new housing going forward. You know, you have that, I guess, on the right, where exceptionality is seen as something positive that needs to be defended, this sort of authentic national, you know, Spanish national culture has to be defended against the sort of empty cosmopolitanism. And on the left, or on progressive Spain more generally, there's an experience of shame, you know, and I think we could see that around the fact that a lot of center-left progressive Spaniards didn't like the attention around the election that Vox got. Some of it was probably justified. I mean, there is a lot of simplifications, but, you know, sure. I mean, if you have 900 words to write for a newspaper, you have to be pretty simple or whatever. So,
yeah,
but there is a certain, you know, you meet a lot of Spanish people who are, you know, who want to be European. They want to be whatever that means. I don't even know what that means, but like, you know, and so you have this experience of these two different distinct reactions to maybe this perceived exceptionality. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's fair to say. And I think I want to address that actually a little bit, because there's been, including a lot of journalists, I follow a lot of journalists like you and on my timeline, there's been a lot of frustration. Actually, so a guest you had, Joe Haslam. Joe gets really irritated by the Franco talk in the newspapers.
Yeah.
And I have to say, in from a journalistic standpoint, a lot of it is lazy. There's a lot of lazy classifications there.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't Spain has I think it's fair to say Spain has a historical memory problem.
Yeah.
And we can't not talk about this when they're going to put José Antonio Primavera's picture on the side of a bus.
Yeah.
How do you, and particularly that figure, because he's a figure, his death, you know, he dies on November 20th, and he is sort of the standard in that time period for a lot of the way in which other figures, there are all these pamphlets that are put out by the church to remember these martyred figures that die for Spain, right? And
you still see his name engraved on cathedrals around Spain, in Granada and Logroño as well. His name, I remember in both, in both cities, left-wing people had thrown paint against his name.
Yeah,
on it. But his name is still engraved on cathedrals around Spain. I mean, it's incredible.
And he's sort of the standard issue model for martyrdom. I had a student who actually did a thesis on these religious pamphlets that were put out to memorialize people. She worked with this really esoteric archive that found all of these. And she sort of, it was really interesting how San Antonio Primavera is sort of the standard issue model of how we go about remembering, memorializing these types of figures. And so to see his picture on the side of a bus nowadays, you can't say that Franco isn't, that nostalgia isn't there. You can't do it. That's also ridiculous. So how do you navigate this? You have podcasts, you have conversations like we're having, first of all, I'd like to think. And I think the other issue in terms of this shame that folks on the left field, what's interesting about Spain too, is it's the least Euroskeptic, or at least until recently. Yeah. Traditionally, it was one of the least Euroskeptic nations in the EU. They bought into the European Union project more than anybody else, particularly because the neoliberalism that the EU promised, right, in terms of this market progressiveness, right, was really beneficial to the Spanish state until about 2008, obviously. Spain really benefited from this economically, from this participation in the European sphere. And so whenever I think about there's a really famous quote from Miguel de Unamuno, who is the Generation IE. That's a really weird classification, but he's actually a Basque philosopher, even though he has a weird relationship to Basque nationalism. And his famous quote is that Europe is a shibboleth, right? That it's a word that if you say it right, if you articulate under the right circumstances, you're allowed in. You get to be part of Europe. And well, what does that mean? Well, that basically means being Europeanized. He calls them nuestros europeizantes, right? That basically reduced us to, he says Franco Alemania, France and Germany, and that's still true to some degree to this day. Yeah. So it's this polar anxiety, and I think part of the reason that the right has been more successful in creating an exceptionality is that it taps into this anxiety of Europeanization and globalization, that we're just going to be like everybody else when everybody wants to be different. I think that's a fundamental core of our identity, is distinguishing ourselves from others. But how do we do that in a way that's inclusive and not exclusionary? And that's, I think, something that the left has really struggled to do in Spain. But something that, and I have to say, I've done the Basque thing a little bit, where I've conflated Pepe and Vox, even though they are different. But I think the Basque left has actually done a politically very expedient thing in saying, no, as long as Vox has a role at the table, we're gonna act like they're the same. And I do think that in terms of the way in which they use nostalgia and the way in which they prey on this fear of a loss of a Spanish self, even though the policies are different and the iconography may be different, I think that playing on that fear is very similar. And I think Isabel Ayuso is tapping into that in a different way than Vox, but she's still tapping into that fear and giving this edgy feminist.
Yeah. Well, I think, as you said, there's something more positive, or it's an assertion. It's an assertion that it's okay to like this stuff. It's okay. This is who we are. We don't have to apologize. This is who we
exactly
are.
Exactly. And I question the left's ability to articulate a nationalism that, and how do you do that generationally when the left has not had access to near the iconography or the culturally the image that you have? You have moments of it. I think the Movida, in the 70s, this embracing of, but even then, I mean, they embrace sort of punk, glam, rock.
Yeah.
These are not movements that come from Spain. They're movements that come from the UK.
And I think, one of the people we had on, it was before Christmas, was Sebastian Faber talking about Javier Marias and that generation of writers, intellectuals, etc., who wanted to be seen as European first and, Spanish second or whatever. And that,
Absolutely.
That was very important for them. No, I mean, I think it's true. I mean, obviously the other issue is, is the plurinational element. I mean, there is, mm-hmm. how do you keep this together? And there is resistance. I mean, one of the positives of the July election was the fact that maybe socialist voters in the south or in the interior of the country, at the end of the day, they feared Vox more than they feared the Catalan and Basque nationalists or whatever, you know, that yeah. they, but how far can you push that? How far can you, you know, one thing is an amnesty, but like an actual referendum, is that going too far? You know, I guess within a media context in which that's going to be, you know, that's going to turn
it's
into
be
something
seen.
Else.
Yeah, it's going to be seen as a very different thing than what probably, than even probably what it is yeah. within the Spanish state.
I mean, the thing is, Sanchez would probably win a referendum in Catalonia right now. I mean, the socialists were by far the largest party in July.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, versus in the Basque Country, you have the PNV and now Eh Bildu, who we cannot put those two groups in the same categories, no. even though they are technically Basque parties. And, you know, what I think, I was thinking about this in another way, when the municipal elections happened, and part of the reason, you know, there's an algorithm in Thailand, but a lot of people who work on mainstream Spain were very surprised by Eh Bildu. And Otegi is somebody, Nardo Otegi is a political figure that was much maligned, right, going back, yeah. obviously. And every time somebody I talk to who works on mainstream Spain or doesn't know much about the Basque Country listens to him, they said, you know, I found myself nodding a lot. I found myself. And I think he's a really interesting political figure. And I think that when you listen to him interviewed, he was talking about this in terms of, you know, we talk about what happened between 1936 and 1939. In the Spanish state, there's one narrative, and you know, they have one narrative and we have a narrative. And he says, it's a waste of time to get into those narratives. What we can say is we're going to make sure that it never happens again. And that's our policy standpoint. And our policy standpoint is defending democratic principles. And I think that Eh Bildu, in terms of this politics of saying, this is who we are and this is what we're going to do. And I think their statement, Egingo dugu, lo haremos, we will do it. Not yes, we can, but we will do it.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I think the departure from Podemos is, yeah. or the distinction
yeah, exactly.
in Podemos
yeah,
is,
it's a nice play on it, actually, yeah.
Is intentional. Yeah. I think it's going to be more successful than people think. And this summer, particularly, we had a lot of Spanish tourism in the Basque Country, more so than normal because it wasn't completely ridiculously hot. And you hear a gentleman actually ask my husband, who they were speaking English because my husband's Spanish isn't great. He asked my husband to take a picture of him and his girlfriend in front of the big Basque flag that's in the Plaza Guipúzcoa. And he said, I want to send it as a WhatsApp to my mother because it's going to freak her out. and he looks at my husband and says, you know, it's just a different generation.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think, like you said, the socialists in the South fear the far right way more than they fear anything that the Basque and the Catalans are going to do. And if the Basque and Catalans can say, yeah, look, we have our culture, but what's part of our culture is defending democratic principles, which benefit you too within the Spanish state. I think that's actually something that can be very, very successful. And if Basque nationalism isn't a threat anymore, and I think the end of terrorism is a big part of this as well. I think we're 10 years outside of terrorism. So that distance is really helping that movement. Yes. And I find it really interesting how many people, and especially with municipal elections, and they did actually did really well, that people were like, this is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's wise that they've resisted this nostalgia a little bit. But I think I want to end. I was thinking about this too, about in terms of nostalgia. There is an example of positive nostalgia in Spain that I want to think about is the new Colacao commercial.
Ah, okay.
Have you seen it?
No, I don't think so. No, tell me. Yeah.
I've never seen it. Okay. So, you know, the original Colacao commercial, right? There's the original. It's from the 1950s.
Okay.
And it's really racist. Okay. Right? Horribly racist. And it disappears in the 1990s. And I mean, this is a song, this is a commercial that is part of like the Spanish DNA. I mean, it's everybody knows the song. And so they recently, in January 2020, they redid the commercial. And the opening line is, hay cosas que nunca cambian, que siempre serán igual. There's things that will never change, will always be the same. And Colacao will always be the same. When we listen to the song, you know, the original song was, you know, it's a Black colonial figure that tells you the story of Colacao, and it's for champions and boxers. And instead, the new song is that it's, you know, footballistas take it, but also creators and artists. And what's great about Colacao is you can make it however you want. that's what's ingrumita de ilusión is the, what's great about it is everybody, it says cada cual a su manera, everyone in their own way.
Okay.
And so it sort of embraces this pluralistic idea. And the reason it stands out to me is because, you know, the song disappeared for a really long time in me because of its racism. And they said they were trying to address the racism of the song and redoing it. And they kept the original tune, which is really, really catchy. If you listen to the song after this, oh, and I'm so sorry, you're going to be singing it for the rest of the day. It's a near one.
Okay.
But when they redid it, I have to tell you, someone who had a child at home in Spain that summer watching television, it was on
all the time.
We heard it 30 times a day. I mean, it was in every commercial break for every cartoon, the commercial was on, and they were really trying to bring it back and tapping into this nostalgia. But again, one that is about embracing individual agency, individual authenticity. And so, you know, I don't want to walk away from this and thinking that nostalgia is 100% a bad thing.
Yeah.
Traditions are important, and I, you know, people enjoy them, and you know, the Basque, and you know, I say this too, that we point the Basque country as something that's totally different. These are not a people that are not traditional. These are people that still lift stones in competition, you know,
yeah, I mean,
at every fiesta.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I mean, I think songs. You should also be able, you know, I mean, there are limits. I would put around bullfighting, etc. I don't encounter
yeah,
reclaimed by
limits.
The left,
yeah,
but you know,
yeah.
I'm a fan of Semana Santa in reality. Oh, like, you know, I mean, I yeah. always, you know, in Madrid, you don't get it. But when I go to the South around Easter, I always, you know, as collective experiences, you know, these collective pageants, as you said, you know,
exactly.
They are sort of incredible watching hundreds of ordinary people, you know, create a pretty impressive spectacle between the music, the, you know,
the food,
sort of,
all of the, it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's appealing. It's beautiful. And when they're community events, right. And I think there is some degree, we can talk about them being spectacles for tourism now, but, but when they are still community events that bring different people together, you know, and again, if they're not exclusionary, if you say, you know, you live here, you're part of this community, even if you're a migrant, even if you're not born here, you're part of this community. We want you involved in these events, and you create this community at the local level too. That resonates from a policy. I think eventually it resonates in a policy standpoint. I really think it does. And so that's why I think, you know, nostalgia isn't always a bad thing. It's just that it can be weaponized.
Yeah.
And if you can identify the process by which that happens, then you can see in which when nostalgia is a spectacle, that a nationalist spectacle, or when nostalgia is a desire to create productive and collective memory. And these two processes, they can look the same, they can feel the same, but they are fundamentally different. One is inclusive, and one is not.
Yeah, wow, I think that's an interesting place maybe to end it.
Yeah.
I have one last question, because it's the Women's World Cup final this Sunday. No, I mean, I think you mentioned football earlier as being part of this sort of potentially toxic masculine nationalism. Whereas it is interesting, the rise of women's football, both domestically, like the league in Spain, etc. You know, the big matches, they tend to fill the major stadiums, etc. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, it's even just purely in terms of, like, it's actually economically accessible to go to these places and watch a world class football game. It is interesting, though, there isn't, I guess, the silence from much of the Spanish right around the fact that Spain are in the World Cup final. I mean, I don't think Vox have been, you know, sharing much about this in comparison, obviously, with the left. I mean, that's I guess, another interesting point.
And I think this is another opportunity where you can tap into a nationalistic, you know, grand spectacle. Sports are a spectacle. I mean, sports, we can look at the history of sports, right? And, you know, the Olympics, you know, you have the Olimpiada Popular in 36,
course, yeah, six,
that they try to organize in Catalonia, as opposed to the racist games. I mean, sports are an ability to bring people together. But I think actually in the spectacle box, that's such a missed opportunity, right? Yeah. Because you can tap into this progressive feminism, but it's still very much the iconography of Spain, and they've been quite quiet on it.
Yeah.
But I think, I still go back to that original Spain World Cup win, that 2008.
Yeah,
it's been a minute.
Because that's I know people have written about that as an important turning point. Yeah, in terms of, like,
absolutely.
A new, you know, right wing Spanish nationalist wave or whatever. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly brought the flag out, and
I think
the use of the flag, and I think that was a big moment, and the Women's World Cup. I think a missed opportunity on the part of the right, but certainly one that the left should capitalize on in terms of defending the values of progressive politics and wanting, and, you know, participation of all people into this field and things like that. I think that that's a And it's also, I'm just a big fan too of, it is accessible. The women's sport, you know, La Liga is expensive. It's really expensive to go to a game. And I think, again, if it makes the sport accessible to more people, I think these women's leagues are wonderful and they're high quality. I thought the French actually, the commercial they did for their team where they AI'd male faces on the female players. It was really great. They basically used AI to make all the female players men, and they replayed all of the skits as if they were the men's team, and, you know, Les Bleus and all this stuff. And then they showed that they had AI'd them, and that all these amazing shots and these amazing the plays were by women. It was great. It was super effective. I think the Spanish can certainly capitalize on that. And it makes me really happy. When I studied abroad, there was a girl in my building who was maybe 15, and every day she'd leave with her soccer ball. And every time I'd watch her outside, and she was playing all with the boys, and she was the only girl. And so, or only woman, I should say. And the fact that the women's team is doing so well in Spanish in the World Cup, it makes me really happy. I was thinking about that young woman today.
Yeah.
And the shift definitely. And the change.
Yeah, no, it has been like generational. Like, yeah, the last 20 years is incredible. Like, yeah.
It's been incredible, and it makes me really happy from the standpoint of women's sports.
Great. Well, look, it's been really interesting talking to you, Brittany. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Cheers.